is the bluebird. Here to stay is a new bird. He sings a love song as we go along, walking in a winter wonderland. In the meadow we can build a snowman, then pretend that he is Parson Brown. He'll say, are you married? We'll say, no, ma'am. But you can do the job when you're in town. Later on, we'll conspire as we dream by the fire to face unafraid the plans that we made, walking in a winter wonderland.
You're listening to the Great American Songbook Holiday Special from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm your host, Phil Furia. Although Bob Wells and Mel Torme were both Jewish, they wrote one of the most beloved Christmas songs, almost by accident. It all started in July of 1946, on one of the hottest days Los Angeles had ever seen. Wells and Torme had been hired to write songs for several Hollywood movies, but when Torme arrived at Bob Wells' home to begin work on the movie songs, he found the lyricist devastated by the heat. These were the days before home air conditioning, and the temperature was in the 90s. "I'm so hot today," Wells told Torme. "I jumped in the pool, took a cold shower, and tried everything I could to cool off. Nothing worked." Amid the fans that were whirling about the room, Torme noticed some phrases Wells had jotted down. "I saw a spiral pad on his piano with four lines written in pencil. They started, chestnuts roasting, Jack Frost nipping, Yuletide carols, folks dressed up like Eskimos." Bob didn't think he was writing a song lyric. He said he thought if he could immerse himself in winter, he could cool off. Wells had started trying to cool off by remembering his childhood growing up in New England. He recalled his mother gathering chestnuts to make stuffing on Thanksgiving, and that led him to the memory of chestnut vendors on street corners when he was trying to make it as a songwriter in New York. Mel Torme persuaded Bob Wells that his verbal efforts to stave off the California heat could be turned into a song. Setting aside their assignment to write songs for movies, Bob Wells and Mel Torme spent the next 45 minutes, sweating in their shirts, writing a Christmas song. It was, like many songs from that era, a catalog song that listed a series of images associated with Christmas, each image evocative and moving without being cloyingly sentimental. But when they took it to their boss, they got thumbs down. "No, fellas," he told them, "no good. The minute you say, 'They know that Santa's on his way,' you make it a one-day song, Christmas Eve. No one's going to buy a tune that's only good one day of the year." Dejected but undaunted, Wells and Torme drove across town to the home of Nat King Cole. Cole listened to the song twice, then said, "That song is mine. Nobody gets that song except me." His instincts were right. Nat King Cole's recording of the Christmas song stayed in the top 10 for nearly 2 months in 1946, then returned as a hit every subsequent year. It was the first Christmas song hit by an African-American performer and opened the doors for other African-American performers such as Louis Armstrong, Ray Charles, and Lou Rawls to record hitherto white Christmas songs. Here it is, sung by Nat King Cole.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeers really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you. Phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
You're listening to the Great American Songbook Holiday Special from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm your host, Phil Furrier. Robert May was an advertising copywriter for Montgomery Ward in Chicago in the late 1930s. Although he had a good job, it was the Great Depression, and times were tough. They got even tougher when his wife Evelyn contracted cancer, and what little money they had was depleted by her medical expenses. Their 4-year-old daughter Barbara couldn't understand why her bedridden mother did not do the things other mothers did with their daughters at Christmas. She asked Robert May, "Why isn't my mommy just like everybody else's mommy?" Robert May put all his skills as an advertising copywriter to work. Since Christmas was near, he made up a story about one of Santa's reindeer, who was different from other reindeer and had to endure teasing and rejection. Barbara loved the story so much she asked her father to tell it to her every night, and it gradually grew more and more elaborate. It became a long poem that May wrote in Anapestic Tetrameter, the same rhythm and meter as Clement Moore's famous "'Twas the Night Before Christmas." May decided that he would create a book complete with illustrations and give it to his daughter as a Christmas present. When his wife died shortly before Christmas, Robert May channeled his grief into completing the little book about the reindeer. After Christmas, Montgomery Ward held an annual holiday party for its workers, and fellow employees asked Robert May to read from the book he had made for Barbara. Their response was enthusiastic, and the head of Montgomery Ward asked Robert May to turn the book into a gift book Montgomery Ward's store Santas could give away to children. He bought the rights to Robert May's story for a small amount of money, and the book became a sensation. 2.5 million copies were given out at Montgomery Ward stores across the country during the Christmas season of 1939. Publishers clamored to put the book on the market for sale. At that point, the head of Montgomery Ward made an astounding decision. He gave all of the rights he had bought to the story of Rudolph back to Robert May, making the advertising copywriter a wealthy man. Then lightning struck again. Robert May's brother-in-law, Johnny Marks, asked if he could turn the story of Rudolph into a song. While Marks had had success with other Christmas songs, he could not interest Bing Crosby or any other major pop singer in recording Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Finally, he went to a Hollywood singing cowboy, Gene Autry, and offered him the song. Autry took it home and played it for his wife, Ina, but told her he thought there were already too many Christmas songs about reindeer. But when Ina heard him sing the line, "They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer games," she was touched and urged her husband to record the song. The song instantly took off, eventually selling more than 8 million copies, second only to Bing Crosby's White Christmas, which sold 30 million records. The success of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer spawned imitations of Christmas novelty songs, but only a few, such as Frosty the Snowman, which Gene Autry recorded the following year, have endured as Christmas classics. Here is Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, sung by Gene Autry.
You know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen, but do you recall the most famous reindeer of all? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows. All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer games. Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, "Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight?" Then how the reindeer loved him as they shouted out with glee, "Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you'll go down in history." And call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer games. Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, "Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight?" Then how the reindeer loved him as they shouted out with glee, "Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you'll go down in history."
I'm Phil Furia, and you are listening to the Great American Songbook Holiday Special from PRI, Public Radio International.
On the next Fresh Air, we do our end-of-year wrap-up in TV and film. I'll give you my top 10 and bottom 5 shows of 2012, and our film critic David Edelstein stubbornly refuses to keep to a top 10 list. He'll give us his top 12 films of the year. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering over 1,000 area rugs, hand-knotted, hand-tufted, and power-loomed. Eastern Rug Gallery also offers a professional cleaning and repair service for Oriental and other fine rugs. Located at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign.
You're listening to WILL AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD3, a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Welcome back to the Great American Songbook Holiday Special from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm your host, Phil Furia. In 1944, amid the darkest days of World War II, producer Arthur Freed wanted to make a musical based on a series of essays author Sally Benson had published in The New Yorker. They were about her childhood growing up in St. Louis during the 1904 World's Fair that celebrated the centenary of the Louisiana Purchase and the Lewis and Clark Expedition. Despite Freed's successful track record making musicals at MGM, studio heads were skeptical of the project about a middle-class family in turn-of-the-century St. Louis. What the hell is Arthur trying to do after all the glamour he has given us? Even screenwriter Sally Benson was critical of the project to dramatize her reminiscences. Nothing much happens, she observed, just little incidents. The only real conflict in the stories erupts when Benson's father, a lawyer, is transferred from St. Louis to New York City and intends to take his family with him, forcing them to miss the St. Louis World's Fair. The boys are all harping on, "There's no plot," Freed countered. "Well, I'll make a plot with song and dance and music. That's the way my characters will come to life. That'll be my plot. I want to make this into the most delightful piece of Americana ever. Sets, costumes, it'll cost a bit, but it will be great." MGM studio head Louis B. Mayer reluctantly gave his go-ahead to Freed, but said, "Either you'll learn or will learn." Initially, Arthur Freed had intended to use only turn-of-the-century songs for Meet Me in St. Louis, such as the title song. But then two young songwriters, Ralph Blaine and Hugh Martin, fresh from a Broadway success called Best Foot Forward, caught his ear. Freed had Blaine and Martin write several new songs for Meet Me in St. Louis. One of these was a bittersweet Christmas song sung by Judy Garland to try to console her younger sister, played by Margaret O'Brien, about leaving St. Louis and moving to New York City. Blaine and Martin took a catchphrase that's usually associated with sour grapes. We say, "Have yourself a merry little party," when we learn that we've not been invited. They transformed that phrase into, "Have yourself a merry little Christmas." Originally, the lyric was even grimmer. "Have yourself a merry little Christmas. It may be your last. Next year we will all be living in the past." But Judy Garland, who had been entertaining troops stationed in California, thought the time was not right for so much despair. "I love the song," Judy said, "but it's too sad. If that lyric is sad, and I'm sad on top of it, the audience is going to say, 'Oh my God,' and they're going to be leaving the theater." The mood of the song was negative, Ralph Blaine agreed, so he revised the lyric to, "Have yourself a merry little Christmas, let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight." Still, it was World War II, and the grim undertone remained. "Someday soon we all will be together, if the fates allow. Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow." When the song was published in sheet music, Blaine tried to lighten the tone even more by changing that last line to, "Hang a shining star upon the highest bough." In the movie Meet Me in St. Louis, Judy Garland's singing of "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas" prompts Margaret O'Brien to rush into the snow-covered yard and smash all of her snowmen because she can't take them to New York City. Her anger then inspires the father to keep the family in St. Louis, and at the end of the film, they all go to the World's Fair. Real life, however, does not have such happy Hollywood endings. Sally Benson's father moved his family from St. Louis to New York City, and they missed the St. Louis World's Fair. Here is Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, sung by Judy Garland.
Someday soon we all will be together if the fates allow. Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow.
You're listening to the Great American Songbook Holiday Special from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm your host, Phil Furia. Although it is one of the simplest and most sincere songs of Christmas, controversy surrounded the creation of I'll Be Home for Christmas. Samuel Ram claimed that he wrote a poem called I'll Be Home for Christmas, Though Just in Memory, as a Christmas present for his mother, when he was a homesick college student, even though the Ram family was Jewish. Later, after he had changed his name from Samuel Ram to Buck Ram, he thought the poem could be the basis of a song. He showed it to two songwriter friends, Kim Gannon and Walter Kent, when they were all drinking at a bar, and left a copy of it with them. In 1942, Buck Ram sold his poem to a music publisher, who wanted to wait a year before releasing it, because they already had a Christmas song for that year, Irving Berlin's White Christmas. When the Christmas season of 1943 rolled around, however, Buck Ram and his music publisher were appalled to find that his friends, Kim Gannon and Walter Kent, had released a song called I'll Be Home for Christmas in a recording by Bing Crosby. Even though the song was completely different from Ram's poem, except for the title, Buck Ram and his publisher sued and got Ram's name included on sheet music and record credits. Like White Christmas, I'll Be Home for Christmas struck a nerve with listeners during the darkest days of World War II. Not only were lots of troops in Europe and the South Pacific spending their first Christmas away from home, many farm workers had to move to large cities to work in factories, and Easterners and Midwesterners moved to California to work in defense plants. a lot of people would not be home for Christmas that year. I'll Be Home for Christmas became one of the most popular songs of the wartime years, and it was the most requested song by soldiers at USO shows in Europe and the South Pacific. It starts out with absolute assurance. I'll be home for Christmas, you can count on me. But then wavers, please have snow and mistletoe. And finally ends up with a plangent nod to reality. I'll be home for Christmas, if only in my dreams. One of the things the singer wishes for may puzzle contemporary listeners. Presents on the tree. Back in the 1930s and 40s, many American families followed the Christmas custom in European countries, in which children go to bed on Christmas Eve, and while they're asleep, St. Nicholas puts a Christmas tree up in their living room, decorates it, and hangs little presents on the branches. With the post-war prosperity of the 1950s, many American families put many large presents, wrapped in Christmas gift paper, around the base of the Christmas tree. Some singers therefore changed the original line, presents on the tree, to presents round the tree. But I prefer the original lyric with its period feel. After the Great Depression of the 1930s and the shortages and rationing during World War II, Christmas presents were few and small enough to hang on the tree. But back to Buck Rahm. His inclusion as one of the creators of I'll Be Home for Christmas established him as a songwriter and helped him move ahead in the music business as a talent manager. His greatest success came with the early rock and roll group, The Platters, for which he wrote such songs as The Great Pretender. He also managed The Platters, and in perhaps his finest moment, defied Mercury Records when it wanted to release The Platters songs on its Purple Race Music label, where other African-American singers had been relegated. Buck Rahm stood up to Mercury Records and insisted that The Platters songs be released on Mercury's mainstream label, thus helping to break down the racial barriers of pop music in the 1950s and ushering in the era of rock and roll. Still, Buck Rahm's most enduring contribution to the Great American Songbook was his inspiration for I'll Be Home for Christmas. Long after World War II, the song remains a holiday classic. In 1965, after the longest space flight then in NASA history, Gemini 7 astronauts Frank Borman and Jim Lovell were asked if they wanted any particular song broadcast to them as they headed back to Earth. The crew called for I'll Be Home for Christmas. Here it is, sung by Elvis Presley.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree. Christmas Eve
listening to the Great American Songbook Holiday Special from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm your host, Phil Furrier. When lyricist Sammy Kahn teamed up with composer Julie Stein in the early 1940s, they went on to write many of the biggest hits of the decade, from I'll Walk Alone to Time After Time. At the height of their success, on an unusually hot day in August in Southern California, Kahn and Stein were waiting at a red light at the corner of Hollywood and Vine. Sammy Kahn suggested, as a way of cooling off, why don't we go to the beach? Stein had a better suggestion for cooling off. Why don't we write a winter song? So they drove to their office at the Morris Music Company, where Stein sat at one desk jotting down musical ideas, while Kahn pecked out lyrics on the typewriter. Then they went over to Stein's house to polish up what would soon be their newest hit, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow. Sammy Kahn always described himself as a vaudeville songwriter, one who wrote a lyric that insistently put a song across to his listeners. Part of that insistence comes from the three repetitions of the title phrase, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow. But part also comes from the way the lyric subtly develops from two lovers simply enjoying a snowstorm while they are cozy inside, to turning the lights down low, and finally, still goodbying, kissing goodnight as the fire is slowly dying. The following year, Kahn said to Stein, remember how lucky we got with that winter song last year? Let's do something for summer. So they sat down and wrote The Things We Did Last Summer, which became another in their long list of hits. Here is Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, sung by Joe Williams.
The weather outside is frightful, but the fire so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping. I brought some corn for popping and turn the lights way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight, how I'll hate going out in a storm. And if you really hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbying. Long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Thank you. outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought some corn for popping. The lights are way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight, how I'll hate going out in a storm. But if you only hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbying. But as long as you love me so, let it snow, 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 let it snow. Oh, go on, let it snow.
I'm Phil Furia, and you are listening to the Great American Songbook Holiday Special from PRI, Public Radio International.
Do you have a favorite recipe you always make for family gatherings? Join WILL-TV in March 2013 for Family Dinner Favorites. We're collecting your recipes for our cookbook, and a few lucky cooks will prepare their recipes live on the air with us. Every recipe we receive will be included in the cookbook. So email your recipe to willmembership@illinois.edu or mail it to recipes at WILL-TV, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Thanks.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by the Regent Ballroom. Winter dance classes start in January with classes in beginners, ballroom, swing, and jazz. The complete class schedule is at regentballroom.com. Dancing is not just for the stars.
You can hear WILL AM 580 online anytime at will.illinois.edu. Just click where it says listen in the top right corner of the page.
Welcome back to the Great American Songbook Holiday Special from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm your host, Phil Furia. Even though he was Jewish, Irving Berlin loved Christmas. His family had fled Russia in 1893 when Berlin, then named Israel Balin, was only 5 years old. Their village had been burned down by Russian Cossacks in a pogrom against Jews. Immigrating to America, Berlin's family settled into the hideous slums of New York's Lower East Side, where their first apartment didn't even have a window. But the slums were also a melting pot, where people of various ethnic, religious, and racial backgrounds lived side by side. While Irving Berlin's father was a cantor in the synagogue, their neighbors, the O'Haras, were Irish Catholics. When the O'Haras put up their annual Christmas tree, young Izzy, as Berlin was nicknamed, was always there. In later years, Berlin realized that the O'Haras were as poor as his family, and that their Christmas tree was always the cheapest one they could find, short, crooked, and with broken branches. But to me, Berlin said, it seemed to tower to heaven. When Berlin married the Catholic socialite, Ellen Mackey, Christmas became an important part of their family life. Thus, when Berlin had to be in Hollywood in 1937 to work on his film Alexander's Ragtime Band, he deeply missed his family, who were celebrating Christmas back in New York, without him. Despondent, Berlin decided to work on a Christmas song for a Broadway show he'd been thinking about. It would be a stage review built around songs about all of the holidays, from New Year's to Christmas. He started with a verse about how balmy the weather was in December in Southern California. The sun is shining, the grass is green, the orange and palm trees sway. There's never been such a day in Beverly Hills, L.A. But it's December the 24th, and I'm longing to be up north. Berlin envisioned the song sung as a mournful Christmas carol by a group of Hollywood sophisticates, sitting around a swimming pool with cocktails and cigarette holders in hand, reminiscing about the Christmases of their youth. In contrast to the days, weeks, months, and even years it took him to complete other songs, Berlin wrote White Christmas in one of his classic all-night marathons of composition. As he described it, the song came to him in one of those rare cases of inspiration. We working composers all too often, in the interest of expediency, sharpen our pencils, get out that square sheet of paper, and become too slick. Those forced efforts are square songs. But sometimes a song is a natural. We may start it to order for a specific scene or show, but our subconscious beings go to work and the song is just there. This is what I call a round song. Maybe because it was so easy to write comparatively, he said later, I didn't realize its potential. White Christmas is a haunting, mournful song that may reflect Berlin's Russian heritage and his nostalgic loneliness as it portrays a singer who can only dream of memories of home, family, and the snowy landscape. While Berlin was never able to mount a stage version of his Holiday Review, he did persuade Paramount Pictures to do a film version called Holiday Inn that starred Bing Crosby. Irving Berlin wrote a song for every holiday of the year and demonstrated them to Crosby. I sang several melodies and Bing nodded quiet approval, Berlin recalled. But when I did White Christmas, he came to life and said, Irving, you won't have to worry about that one. White Christmas won the Academy Award for Best Song. Coming out shortly after America had entered World War II after Pearl Harbor, it became a favorite of troops fighting in Europe and especially in the South Pacific. It became a peace song in wartime, Berlin said. Nothing I'd ever intended. It was nostalgic for a lot of boys who weren't at home for Christmas. Here is Irving Berlin's White Christmas, sung by Bing Crosby. You're listening to the Great American Songbook Holiday Special from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm your host, Phil Furia. Haven Gillespie was one of the few songwriters of his generation who did not live in New York or Hollywood, then the two centers of popular music. Instead, he preferred to write his lyrics in his hometown of Covington, Kentucky, just across the Ohio River from Cincinnati. Born into a dirt-poor Irish-American family of nine children, Haven dropped out of school in the fourth grade to do odd jobs to help support the family. His older brother, Irwin, had taken music lessons and landed a job playing the calliope on steamboats on the Ohio River. Irwin Gillespie encouraged Haven to go into songwriting and taught him how to read and write music. Haven began writing lyrics for songs in the late 1920s and had some hits such as Drifting and Dreaming and Breezin' Along with the Breeze. He even set up his own sheet music publishing firm in Covington. That meant, however, that he periodically had to go to New York to peddle his firm's songs. On one of these trips to New York in 1934, he learned that his brother Irwin had died suddenly of pneumonia back in Kentucky. Irwin's last words had been to encourage Haven to pursue his songwriting career. At that same time, a New York music publisher asked Haven Gillespie to write lyrics to a children's Christmas song. At first, Haven Gillespie resisted, saying that it was already September and that was too late to start writing a Christmas song. He also worried that a Christmas song would easily be forgotten after the holidays. But the music publisher persisted, and Haven Gillespie realized that the assignment was one, as he later put it, any songwriter would have traveled on his hands and knees from Hollywood to Timbuktu to get. Still with his brother Irwin's death heavy on his mind, he doubted he could summon the happy spirits needed for a children's Christmas song. He met his collaborator, composer J. Fred Coots, on a cold, rainy day in downtown New York. As they walked to the subway to head uptown to work on the song, Haven Gillespie stuffed some paper in his shoes to soak up the rain. Once on the subway, Haven Gillespie was too sad to come up with any ideas for a lyric to Coots' melody. In a desperate attempt to get Gillespie's lyrical imagination working, Coots called out the names of streets they were passing under. Soon, Haven Gillespie began recalling his childhood with his brother Irwin, and how, as Christmas neared, their mother would say things like, "If you don't wash behind your ears, Santa won't come to see you. You better be good." Haven Gillespie took a soggy piece of paper from out of his shoe and began to jot down some lyrics. By the time they reached uptown, he had written most of the lyric for Santa Claus is Coming to Town. The music publisher thought the lyric was terrible, throwing corn all over Broadway, as he put it, and other songwriters made fun of such childish lines as Rudy Toot Toots and Rummy Tum Tums. But one person who loved the song was Eddie Cantor's wife, Ida, who persuaded her husband to sing it on his Thanksgiving Day radio show in 1934. Santa Claus Has Come to Town became an overnight sensation and was soon selling 25,000 copies of sheet music a day. For Haven Gillespie, the success was bittersweet. He had lost his beloved brother Irwin, but his song had fulfilled Irwin's belief in Haven as a lyricist. Here is Santa Claus Is Coming to Town, sung by Ray Charles.
You better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Look at him. He's making a list, and he's checking it twice. He's gonna know who's been naughty or nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. Do you hear me? Well, listen. He knows if you are sleeping. Yeah, he knows if you're awake. And he knows if you've been good or bad. So you better be good, for goodness sake. Hey, you better watch out, and you better not cry. You better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming down. All right, look out, here he comes. Thank you.
tell you. He knows if you are sleeping. Yeah, he knows if you're awake. They tell me he even knows if you're good or bad. So you better be good for goodness sake. Girls and boys, you better watch out. And you better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why now. Santa Claus is coming down. You know, it's supposed to be a secret, but I can't keep it just to myself. Santa is coming to town. You know, kids, you better be good. I'm talking about showing off good. Santa Claus coming to town. You know, if you want everything you want, Santa Claus, the man's coming to town. I'm gonna say it just one more time here. Santa Claus, he's coming to town.
That concludes our Great American Songbook Holiday Special from PRI, Public Radio International. The Great American Songbook originates from public radio station WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina, where it is produced by George Scheibener. For more information about the Great American Songbook series, go to whqr.org. Thanks for listening to the Great American Songbook Holiday Special. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. I'm your host, Phil Furia, wishing you, in the words of Irving Berlin, happy holiday.
Public Radio International.
On Talk of the Nation, we'd like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation. Clear, straight, open. From NPR News.
Weekday afternoons at 1 on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to visit the Promenade Gift Shop for artfully affordable and exceptionally eclectic gifts. More information on upcoming events is at KrannertCenter.com.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.